said that the school watchman even refused to open the gates to let the girls out. Relatives of the girls are understandably upset. We spend a lot of time talking about Iran's mullahs, but as bad as they are, and they're bad, they've got more than their match in Saudi Arabia.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Already heard from the radical right. All that's left is the truth. Later, gang.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am not one to quote from the Book of Revelations very often, but early on in my radio career, I described the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four most evil, most intelligent men who I felt were the greatest danger to our country. I should say, of course, that George Bush wasn't among them. He may have some level of evil, but I didn't think he was intelligent enough to really be running the country. No, my four horsemen of the apocalypse were Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Tom DeLay, and Antonin Scalia. And they were in all branches of government. They controlled all aspects of our existence. Dick Cheney controlling our foreign policy, Karl Rove controlling our politics and our domestic policy, Tom DeLay controlling all legislation then going through Congress, and Scalia, dear Antonin Scalia, controlling our judicial system. Well, Karl Rove is gone. He's certainly in the background. He's certainly doing his best to worm his way through Fox News into controlling our lives. He may well be in the background, but he's officially out of power. Tom DeLay is also out of power, finally indicted for his many crimes. His power is largely gone. Dick Cheney, thankfully, in only, what is it now? It's May, so 8 months, we will finally be rid of the terror that is Dick Cheney. But the fourth horseman of the apocalypse, Antonin Scalia, the one perhaps that you hear the least about, the one that in some sense has more power than all the others, if only because he is the one who put the others in power. You know, he will probably remain with us a long time. At age 72, there's no doubt that he will be with us until the day he dies. He is a strong-willed man, and he could well be with us for the next 20 years. What also distinguishes Scalia from the other three horsemen of the apocalypse is that I know him best. I've never met Karl Rove or Dick Cheney. I have met Tom DeLay. Indeed, I was in the room with Tom DeLay on the day the conference committee approved the Patriot Act. I have no doubt of that man's evil, nor do I have doubt that the former pest control man can and has captured a fly between his hands and crushed the life out of it. But Scalia is someone I've not only watched, not only seen in person, as I have Tom DeLay, he's someone I've challenged, intellectually challenged. And for all the brilliance and all the love of argument that Scalia is famous for, I beat him 2-for-2. I've told this story on the air a few times. It's been several years. It's always worth telling again how when I attended Yale Law School in 1992, Antonin Scalia came to speak before us, and how, yes, I think you'll find I bested him in intellectual argument. And I'm not saying that to brag, although, hey, I can't deny there's a little bit of presumptuousness and arrogance in what I'm saying. I'm really saying it to show that Scalia is like a huge bag of hot air, but one that's easily pricked. And then all the hot air comes zooming out. He's so rarely challenged because there's so rarely anyone to challenge him. I was in a perfect circumstance. I was a law student. I had nothing to fear from him. If I were to appear before him in the United States Supreme Court, I would have to be deferential. That's what they teach you as a lawyer. Indeed, it's one of the first things they teach you as a lawyer, no matter how harsh a judge's questions might be, no matter how stupid a judge might be, no matter how illogical a judge might be, well, you are required to be nice to the person. After all, they control the future of your case. And that makes sense in a legal argument context. But one of the things about Scalia that makes him Scalia is that he's someone who loves to go around and defend his principles as he sees them, and he considers himself impervious to logical argument. He is so certain that he's right that he's willing to take all comers, and I got to say I respect him for that. Yes, I respect Antonin Scalia for that aspect of himself. Justice Thomas certainly won't allow intellectual disagreement, neither would, for that matter, Rehnquist. But Scalia is so sure of himself that he, like me, when I go on those debate Tuesdays with Republican opponents, I believe I'm right. And because I believe I'm right, I am willing to entertain the views of those who disagree with me. Scalia similarly believes he's right and is willing to entertain the views of those who disagree. But as you'll see from my two examples, from the only time, the only day where I have met and tangled with Scalia. I've seen him in person since then, but there's only that one beautiful day when I actually had a chance to argue with him that shows that Scalia is a big old hypocrite. Unfortunately, Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes either didn't have the intellectual fortitude or know-how or cojones to go after Scalia the way I did. And even though 60 Minutes is known for exactly that, is known for taking on the big guys, well, they just did a puff piece last Sunday. Really, it was very praiseworthy. She didn't lay a hand on him. She hardly tried. And you will hear throughout the clips, which I'm going to play this hour, how she is practically singing his praises. But I want to play some of that interview. I want to respond to some of that interview. And then I want to tell you the story of my own run-in with Antonin Scalia, where I challenged him on some things that I don't think he expected a challenge on, and showed his views to be, well, let's just say empty. Let me start with the interview. I'll be interrupting it on occasion. And, of course, all of you are more than welcome to join in the discussion, to tell me what you think of either the interview or what I have to say. As always, just pick up the phone and dial 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Let me start with the beginning of Leslie Stahl's interview on 60 Minutes. Listen to how much she praises him. And then we'll talk about the holes in Scalia's arguments.
Not many Supreme Court justices become famous. Antonin Scalia is one of the few. Known as Nino to his friends and colleagues, he's one of the most brilliant and combative justices ever to sit on the court, and one of the most prominent legal thinkers of his generation. He first agreed to talk to us about a new book he's written about how lawyers should address the court. But over the course of several conversations, our story grew into a full-fledged profile, his first major television interview, including discussions about abortion and Bush v. Gore. At 72, Justice Scalia is still a maverick, championing a philosophy known as originalism, which means interpreting the Constitution based on what it originally meant to the people who ratified it over 200 years ago. Justice Scalia has no patience with so-called activist judges who create rights not in the Constitution, like a right to abortion, by interpreting the Constitution as a living document that adapts to changing values.
Okay, let's just stop right there. Just stop right there for a second. First of all, is he brilliant? Yes, he's very smart. I don't deny it. I admit it. The guy's smart. Okay, fine. Is he a prominent legal thinker? He is. He is. Yeah, I like the way he asks, you know, he wants to address how a lawyer should address the court. Like I said, one of the advantages of being a law student, as I was when I addressed him, is I didn't have to be as deferential as a lawyer has to be. But the heart of Scalia's argument, the heart of his argument is what Leslie Stahl mentioned. It is this idea of originalism. And let me say this. If Scalia was truly an originalist, I wouldn't have as much of a problem with him. I shall repeat. If Scalia truly was an originalist, I would respect his position. I might disagree with it in some instances. But I would recognize, if he were intellectually consistent, that that is an intellectually consistent position to take. And it is. It is fair to say that a constitution is meant to overturn the rule of the majority, which it is. I mean, let's face it, the majority rule rules in legislatures, rules in Congress, but the intent of a constitution is to protect individuals from majority rule. That's why we have the Bill of Rights. The majority might pass a law banning flag burning or taking away a prisoner's rights to have a trial because the public thinks he's guilty. But the whole purpose of the Constitution is to protect individuals against majority rule. So that, in and of itself, is not controversial. Now, the larger idea, and we'll get into this, is to whether a constitution should evolve with time. And there's all kinds of different ways to think about that. We'll get into some of that, Scalia's ideas and Ginsburg's ideas. The problem with Leslie Stahl's interview is that she takes Scalia at his word. She presumes that because he proclaims himself an individualist, an originalist, because he says he's an originalist, he is an originalist. She thinks that because he's best known for this philosophy, and because he spouts this philosophy, that he actually believes this philosophy. And I will go one further. I believe Scalia believes this philosophy. I think he thinks that's where he is. But he's wrong. Because when push comes to shove, when Bush comes to Gore, and that's not the only example, Scalia will throw his entire philosophy out the window in order to achieve his deeper priority. A priority best exemplified perhaps by his father, who was an immigrant from Italy and who declared his loyalty to Benito Mussolini, the Italian fascist leader. Scalia's mind may be on originalism, but his id is on the kind of state-slash-corporate control that is famous for Mussolini's fascism. And this is what I think I'll be able to show over the next hour. So, understand, there is a real legitimate question in the law of originalism versus an evolving constitution, and that's best shown, as Leslie Stahl does, between Scalia and another hero of mine, Justice Ginsburg. Not that Scalia's a hero, he's not, but she's one of many heroes of mine. But actually, I don't know that I would agree necessarily with Justice Ginsburg either. In fact, in law school, I was called the textualist. And we'll go over some legal philosophy this hour. What is the difference between an originalist, a textualist, and an evolving constitution? Well, an originalist, which is what Scalia claims to be, even though he's not, even though he's a hypocrite, an originalist says that whatever the people who wrote the document believed, that's the original understanding, that's what you have to stick with. If the people who wrote the Constitution believed in slaves, you got to stick with slavery. Now, there are amendments to get rid of slavery, but basically the rest of it has to stay the same because that's what they believed in. Or if you believe in evolving standards, which Justice Ginsburg does, then you understand that the Constitution is a living document that changes with the time. I would argue there's actually a third option, a middle option, a compromise option, the option that I adopted in law school, and that's a textualist. You look at the text. You look at what the words mean. You respect the language of the law. That's where I've always gone. In other words, if equality under the law means today that all people are treated equally, it matters not that the people who wrote equality under the law were racist or sexist or homophobic. I don't care what their original intent was. They wrote equality under the law. I don't have to go into their minds. I got the text in front of me. That's Mark Levine's view on the law. And it requires neither original intent nor evolving standards, which I can understand how some could interpret as being whatever a judge thinks or believes. And I don't think a judge should do whatever he or she thinks or believes. I do think he or she should be bound by the language of the law. Textualism, as I propose it, almost never gets discussed in this battle between originalism and an evolving constitution. And, of course, Leslie Stahl doesn't mention it. But I thought I'd give you my view before you hear how Leslie Stahl frames the issue.
Well, what's wrong with the living constitution? What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it is it's wonderful imagery, and it puts me on the defensive as defending presumably a dead constitution.
Well?
Well, it is an enduring constitution that I want to defend.
But what you're saying is let's try to figure out the mindset of people back 200 years ago. Right?
It isn't the mindset. It's what did the words mean to the people who ratified the Bill of Rights or who ratified the Constitution?
As opposed to what people today think it means.
As opposed to what people today would like.
But you do admit that values change. We do adapt. We move.
That's fine. And so do laws change. Because values change, legislatures abolish the death penalty, permit same-sex marriage if they want, abolish laws against homosexual conduct. That's how the change in a society occurs. Society doesn't change through a constitution.
Well, now, let's stop there, and let's give the devil his due. What he's saying is that there are certain things that a legislature should change rather than be required by the Constitution. I'll accept that. There are certain things a legislature should change. The tax rate should never be determined by the Constitution. The 16th Amendment says you can have income taxes, fine. You can. The rate, that's set by Congress. But the issues that he described, same-sex marriage, for example, that to me is precisely an issue that should be determined by the Constitution, because that's an issue where you have individual freedoms up against a majority will. It seems to me that the clear time when democracy should not be the tyranny of the majority is when the majority wants to take away an individual's equal freedom. In other words, if Mississippi is majority white and votes that only whites can vote, they shouldn't be able to do that, even if the majority of Mississippi wants it. Even if 52% of Mississippians, including blacks, because they're not a majority, want all blacks to lose their right to vote, I'm sorry, you can't do that. The Constitution has to protect it. And even if the majority of Americans, who, let's face it, the majority of Americans are straight, even if the majority of Americans say gay people should have less rights than straight people, sorry, equal protection under the law means you cannot pass a law that says, I'm sorry, straight people get all these rights, gay people get less rights. You cannot pass a law that says white people get these rights, black people get less rights. You can pass a law that says, okay, you're taxed at this rate. The whole purpose of a constitution, more than anything else, it does many things. It does separation of powers. It says what Congress can do and the president can do, and it sets up how you elect a president and how you elect a member of Congress. It does lots of things. But to me, the primary purpose of a constitution, the most important aspect of a constitution, is the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, the part that protects an individual against the overweening power of the state. And the examples that Scalia just gave are perfect examples of when you need a constitution. Needless to say, Leslie Stahl doesn't challenge him on those. We'll go on.
A mission as an evangelist for originalism at home and around the world.
Welcome, Justice Antonin Scalia.
Here he is at the Oxford Union in England.
Sometimes people come up to me and inquire, you know, Justice Scalia, when did you first become an originalist? You know, as though it's some weird affliction. You know, when did you start eating human flesh?
They may be laughing, but in the U.S., Justice Scalia is a polarizing figure.
Scalia is a fascist!
Who invites protesters and picketers. There haven't been many Supreme Court justices who become this much of a lightning rod.
I'm surprised at how many people really, really hate you. These are some things we've been told. He's evil. He's a Neanderthal. He's going to drag us back to 1789. They're threatened by what you represent and what you believe in.
These are people that don't understand what my interpretive philosophy is. I'm not saying no progress. I'm saying we should progress democratically.
Yeah. You think there ought to be a right to abortion? No problem. The Constitution says nothing about it. Create it the way most rights are created in a democratic society. Pass a law. And that law, unlike a constitutional right to abortion created by a court, can compromise. It can see. Oh, I was going to say it can split the baby. I should not use it. The Constitution is not meant to facilitate change. It is meant to impede change, to make it difficult to change.
But as critics argue that originalism is a cover for what they see as Justice Scalia's real intention, to turn back some pivotal court decisions of the 60s and 70s.
You've been labeled a counter-revolutionary.
A counter-revolutionary.
The idea being...
Sounds exciting.
Let's stop it right there. She doesn't interview any of the critics. She does interview Justice Ginsburg, who talks about her idea of an evolving constitution, and we'll get to that. I think you should hear from Justice Ginsburg. But Scalia's idea, as he proposes it, and yes, he is funny. All right, I'll grant that. He is. He's good at telling a joke. He's good at being a spokesperson for originalism. And if he actually were an originalist, I would respect him more. You see what he says? He says, critics that don't like my views don't like it because they don't agree with originalism. And that's possible. That's true for some. The real problem with Scalia is he's a hypocrite. When push comes to shove, he is not an originalist. No clearer example of that can possibly be had than Bush v. Gore. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution that gives the Supreme Court the right to overturn state elections, including the state election for President of the United States. The procedure for the Electoral College is clearly spelled out in the Constitution. And the federal law on the matter, how you count the electoral votes, is also clearly spelled out. There was a time when it wasn't. And then came the great 1876 debacle, the Tilden-Hayes election, where the Supreme Court stepped in. It actually wasn't the Supreme Court. It was five members from the House, five from the Senate, and five from the Supreme Court. And the commission had seven Democrats, seven Republicans, one independent. The independent died, and they threw a Republican in, and lo and behold, Rutherford B. Hayes won the election 8-7. So they put a process in place. And they said, in effect, that it is up to the state to decide whether or not the electors are valid or not. And under Florida law, that last decision is made by the Florida Supreme Court. The Supreme Court literally had no power to even give an opinion on the issue. And, well, if you believe in states' rights, which, after all, conservatives proclaim they love states' rights. States' rights were the main thing keeping black people from voting. They didn't seem to understand that a U.S. Constitution should overturn state rights where equal protection was an issue. But they love states' rights. They would have stayed out of the case. But if they'd done that, Al Gore would be our president today. When Scalia's rock-bottom principles, meaning his conservative, Republican, Catholic, somewhat fascist philosophy, conflicted with originalism, originalism went out the window. And like I said, Leslie Stahl doesn't talk about that. I will. I'm going to give some more examples, including my own run-in with Antonin Scalia. And I'll give you all the legal background. I'll let you judge it for yourself. Let's go on, though, with the 60-minute interview.
The critics say his aim is to undo Roe v. Wade and affirmative action and allow more religion in public life.
The public sense of you is that you make your decisions based on your social beliefs. So, what? That is the perception.
I'm a law and order guy. I mean, I confess I'm a social conservative, but it does not affect my views on cases. On the abortion thing, for example, if indeed I were, trying to impose my own views, I would not only be opposed to Roe versus Wade, I would be in favor of the opposite view, which the anti-abortion people would like adopted, which is to interpret the Constitution to mean that a state must prohibit abortion.
And you're against that?
Of course, it's just not
in the Constitution.
There's nothing there on that.
They didn't write about that.
They did not write about that.
His philosophy has occasionally led him to decisions he deplores.
We'll get to that in a second. Let me talk about abortion. Let me talk about Roe v. Wade. This may surprise you, what I'm about to say. But if I had been a justice in the great Roe v. Wade opinion, I wouldn't have signed on to the opinion. Shocker! Liberal Radio, what is Mark saying? I'm saying that I respect the law. And I respect the text of the law. And I don't like the way Roe v. Wade was written. I'll tell you that right now. It's not the most persuasive case in the universe. It bases a woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion on the right to privacy. Now, I agree that the right to privacy is in the Constitution. It's in the Constitution because, and I'll get to that when I talk about my conversation with Scalia a little bit later on, but basically it was a right that was part of an English law common right, a man's home is his castle, and I would argue it's in the Constitution based on the Ninth Amendment, which leaves certain rights controlled by the people. I'll get to that. I'll explain that a little bit later. I know I haven't explained that yet. But I would have concurred in the result of Roe v. Wade. Because I, like Justice Ginsburg, see another constitutional provision that does protect a woman's right to choose. Not the one they cite in Roe v. Wade, not the right to privacy. I agree it's somewhat a stretch to say a woman's right to choose is based on the right to privacy. To me, the clear textual support for protecting a woman's right to control what happens to her own body is the Fourth Amendment, which I will read to you. The right of the people to be secure in their persons houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. La, 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 la. Did you get that? We have a right in the Fourth Amendment, expressly textually in the Constitution, to be secure in our persons against unreasonable seizures. When a state prohibits a woman from doing what she wants with her own body, she is not secure in her person. Her person is being seized. And frankly, if you look at the pure textual language, I don't know how else you can read that. What is a state forcing a woman to do certain things with her own body, but a seizure of her body? And that can't be done but without probable cause to believe that she's committed some kind of crime. So I think the Fourth Amendment very strongly supports a woman's right to choose. I happen to think Roe v. Wade was not the best written decision. I think, actually, that that shows some intellectual honesty on my part. As a liberal, I support a woman's right to choose. As a lawyer, I recognize that some opinions are better than others, and I happen to think Roe v. Wade is not the best reasoned decision. I would reason it based on the Fourth Amendment. So I would concur in judgment, as they say in the law, rather than join the opinion. So there's a reason why Scalia brings up abortion all the time. Because he knows, as an intellectual, that Roe v. Wade is not the best written opinion in the world. He's going to hit that weak reed without ever talking about the other possibility, the possibility under the Fourth Amendment. And I'm actually going to give the devil his due. Not all people are 100% evil. There is one decision that Scalia did rule rightly on. It's very rare. It's very rare that he's done the right thing, and I think he did it because, well, the consequences weren't so severe. But let me play the one time I think Scalia did make the right decision.
Like his upholding the constitutionality of flag burning, as he told a group of students in Missouri.
If it was up to me, I would have thrown bearded, sandal-wearing flag burner into jail. But it was not up to me.
To Scalia, flag burning was protected by the Founding Fathers in the First Amendment, which is his only criterion, he says, under originalism.
So he ruled the correct way on flag burning. Way to go. Way to go. Good job. That's me clapping, by the way. He made one right decision. I'll give the devil his due. But as I say, the real problem with Scalia is not originalism versus an evolving constitution. The real problem with Scalia is when he's not following his own ideas. Let me play just once more his view of originalism, and I'm going to give Ginsburg's view on an evolving constitution. We'll talk about that. And then I'm going to tell you about, well, my run-ins with Scalia. And then we'll move on to Bush v. Gore. But first, Scalia on originalism before the British.
Over the last several years, Justice Scalia has reached outside the court, speaking out publicly about his philosophy in hopes of influencing the next generation. It's a role he relishes.
Little kids come to the court. They're brought by their teachers, and they recite very proudly what they've been taught. I mean, this is how, you know, widespread they're not. The Constitution is a living document, you know, and I have to tell them it's a dead document. That's it.
And here's Justice Ginsburg.
There must be other views because I've seen them.
Yeah, but you... Just to be clear, it begins with Scalia mocking the idea that any other view on the issue of originalism could have merit.
But there must be other views because I've seen them.
Yeah, but you respect them.
I
you don't, do you?
I respect the people who have them, but I think those views are just flat out wrong.
He's talking about some of his fellow justices, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal who is, and this never ceases to surprise people, one of his best friends, both on and off the court.
I see the Constitution as striving for a more perfect union.
To her, the Constitution evolved and should reflect changes in society. That going back to what was meant originally when they wrote, for instance, "We the People," makes little sense.
Who were we the people in 1787? You would not be among we the people. African Americans would not be among the people.
So you can see Justice Ginsburg's point. And actually, it doesn't disagree with mine. We the people, in original intent, did not include women, did not include slaves, did not include non-white Christian men owning property. Those weren't the people. But they are the people today. So Ginsburg says that's evolved. We understand the people to be that today. That's an evolving standard. Me, I look at it as a textualist, and I say, today, that's what the people means. That's what the text means. We're not changing the text. The text says the people. We are the people. That's everybody. Rich and poor, black and white, male and female, gay and straight, atheist, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, we're all the people. And you don't have to even force it to put it in the text. So I come to the same result as Ginsburg. I am, though, a little fearful of people that talk about evolving standards, and that's where I might disagree with Ginsburg, because I fear that some conservative on a court could use the idea of evolving standards to go in any direction. I understand, actually, Scalia's criticism of that idea, as it could be taken too far. But again, if you look at an issue like torture, and we'll get to Scalia's views on torture. Torture is not defined. He's right about that. It's not defined. But there, because it isn't defined, we simply rely on the text. And what may not have been considered torture in 1787, a time when they had duels and were drawing and quartering people, is considered torture today. Indeed, some ideas of torture have been considered torture ever since the Spanish Inquisition, including waterboarding. Scalia would have us believe that that view has changed in the last 10 years, even though it's been consistent for several millennia. So that's his evolving standard. I want to talk to you about one of my confrontations with Scalia. I had two, and I'm very proud of both of them. But I want to show you how I turned Scalia's originalism against him. How I used my belief, which is I believe in the text of the Constitution. In fact, if you just look at my way of approaching the Constitution and Scalia's way, you might say they're closer to each other than Ginsburg's and mine, because I believe in relying on the text. I don't believe you should go outside the text of the law. If you don't like the text of the law, I agree with Scalia, change the law. But he happens to like certain texts better than other texts. When he came to Yale Law School and he did what he's done so well there with the British and Oxford, who probably don't know our Constitution as well as American law students, and he brags and he boasts and he gives jokes and he talks about how he's the true originalist. I remember distinctly him appearing before us and a student before me asking about the Second Amendment. How does he interpret the Second Amendment, the one that says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed? Well, Scalia very gingerly avoided the whole question of the militia, even though it's in the text, and said, bear arms, the right of the people to bear arms. Well, it shall not be infringed. And the student said to him, well, what about nuclear weapons? Are you saying that everyone has a right to have nuclear weapons? He says, nuclear warheads are heavy. Bear means to carry, from the Latin for, and he gave a Latin word. It means to carry. Can you pick up a gun? You can. Can you pick up a nuclear warhead? You can't. There you go. You can regulate nuclear warheads. And everybody laughed. Everybody laughed, by the way, he was taking that text absolutely literally. Obviously, you can bear anthrax. I guess that's okay too, Justice Scalia. But you got his point. I take the Constitution literally, he's saying. You can bear a gun, you can't bear a nuclear warhead. Next question. Lots of laughter, some applause. He gets his giggle in, and he's made his point. Going through, giving Latin things. So I raise my hand, and I ask him about an amendment in the Bill of Rights that I dare say most non-lawyers have never heard of. The Ninth Amendment. My personal favorite, by the way. I like them all, but I really like the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment says, the enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I asked Justice Scalia how the Ninth Amendment restricted government power. He said, the Ninth Amendment is merely precatory, which is a wonderful big legal phrase to say advisory. The Ninth Amendment is an advisory thing. It's like the preamble to the Constitution. It says to legislatures, be careful. Be careful. Don't take away people's rights. But it doesn't really have any force. It's an admonition. It's a warning. It's a, be careful, folks. I said, Justice Scalia, you don't really believe an amendment to the Constitution. A change in the Constitution is mere preamble, is mere advisory. They're changing the Constitution. It has to mean something. He says, let's go through. He says, look, the First Amendment, he says, and I remember this like it was yesterday. I'll never forget this. And we had an audience of a couple hundred people. So if ever Scalia were to challenge this account, I got a couple hundred witnesses. He goes through and he says, First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Amendment 2, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Amendment 3, no soldier shall be quartered in your home. Shall. Mandatory. He says, but the Ninth Amendment says, the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed. I said, shall! I interrupted the justice. I said, shall! It's mandatory just like the others. He said, wait, let me finish. The Ninth Amendment, the enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. He says those rights are not specified in the Ninth Amendment, so it's merely a warning to legislatures, be careful. I said, Justice Scalia, I'm not the Latin scholar that you are, but I want to talk about the word construed. The Ninth Amendment says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I said, with due respect, Justice Scalia, legislatures don't construe laws. They make laws. They annul laws. They repeal laws. They amend laws. They decide what the law is. They don't construe law. With due respect, and your knowledge of Latin, Justice Scalia, I said, doesn't construe mean interpret? Doesn't construe mean to take something that's ambiguous and decide what it means? Isn't construction of the laws precisely what the courts do? Didn't they say in the great case of Marbury versus Madison, it is the province of the courts to interpret the law? Isn't the Ninth Amendment restricting you, Justice Scalia, not a legislature, but restricting you, mandatorily requiring you to construe laws so as not to deny or disparage rights retained by the people? He said, but what rights are there? He actually stammered. I remember that. But what rights are there? What rights? The Ninth Amendment doesn't say. I said, well, shouldn't it at least be the rights retained by the people? That's the words of the language, retained by the people. In other words, the rights they had when the Constitution was adopted. There were certain rights understood in the common law and English law when this Constitution was adopted. Don't the people retain those rights? And isn't the court restricted from prohibiting those rights? And isn't one of those retained rights the old adage that a man's home is his castle? In other words, you have a right to privacy. It is an ancient English right. You had it in 1787. You had it in 1791. And the enumeration of certain rights in this Constitution, the fact that it mentions other rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, shall not be construed. You, the courts, cannot construe the law to deny or disparage these other rights that the people have, these basic human rights that were recognized by the English back in 1791. And he said, this is pretty much a direct quote, you've now asked me 6 questions in a row. You've had enough time. I'm going to ask someone else another question. At which point, the crowd cheered and clapped. And I don't know, maybe I built it up in my own mind, but I think I recall a standing ovation for me, not for him. For the fact that he admitted, by moving on, that he couldn't answer my question. Because my question restrained him. in my question, the Constitution restrained Scalia, not the legislature, not the government, and it specifically protected something that he denied existed, the right to privacy in the Constitution based on the English common law. He couldn't answer the question, so he moved on. And I do remember the cheers of my fellow law students. And that's precisely my point. The answer to fighting Scalia is not, as Justice Ginsburg does, and I respect that she has her own views and she's going to fight on her own turf, and I respect that. But Leslie Stahl and myself and others who wish to challenge Scalia should not do so on the basis of, well, he's an originalist and liberals believe in an evolving constitution. I say, just like when I go after people who argue the Bible with me, I don't argue the Bible is untrue. We don't get anywhere with that. We don't get anywhere. They say it's true. I say it's untrue. There's no point continuing the argument. With people who argue the Bible with me, I argue the Bible back. I say it's easier for a rich man, for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. I talk about how Jesus cared about the poor, and I ask them whether they're being true to biblical principles. That doesn't mean I accept the New Testament. It means I know how to argue on their turf. I took Scalia down on his turf. I strictly construed, there's that word again, the Ninth Amendment. I went word by word by word. I'm going to repeat it. It is my favorite amendment. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I went word by word by word, definition by definition. He had to concede I was right, and indeed he did so by moving on to another question. That isn't the only time I took down Justice Scalia, I'm proud to say. I'll give you my other time in just a few minutes. First, I want to play more from the interview between him and Leslie Stahl. Bob Kincaid has played some of this. In fact, he's the one who inspired me to go and check out the original 60 Minutes interview that I'm going on at greater length. But you got to hear one more time how Antonin Scalia deals with Bush v. Gore.
Of all the cases that have come before him on the court, Bush v. Gore may have been the most controversial. It has been reported that he played a pivotal role in urging the other justices to end the Florida recount, thereby handing the 2000 election to George Bush. The subject came up at the Oxford Union.
Supposing yourself as a Supreme Court justice were granted the power to appoint the next president of the United States, who would you pick and why, and would he or she be better than your last choice?
You want to talk about Bush versus Gore? I perceive that. I and my court owe no apology whatever for Bush versus Gore. We did the right thing, so there.
People say,
so there. That's his argument. So there. Did you hear it? I could repeat it. I know it's complex and legal and really hard to understand, it, dealing with all those laws that he cites. And he says, we did the right thing, so there. Oh, let's just play it one more time, because it's very complex. Let's see if you got it. Why did he do the right thing in Bush v. Gore?
I and my court owe no apology whatever for Bush versus Gore. We did the right thing, so there.
So there. Like a petulant child, like a three-year-old who wants his toy. I don't want to give you my toy or your toy back. I don't want to give you your toy back. So there. Where's all that intellectualism? Where's all that brilliance? Could it be that Antonin Scalia doesn't want to discuss Bush v. Gore because he knows it is intellectually impossible to defend the decision? Let's hear how he responds to Leslie Stahl.
People say that that decision was not based on judicial philosophy, but on politics.
I say nonsense.
Was it political?
Gee, I really don't want to get in. I mean, this is, get over it. It's so old by now. The principal issue.
You got that? Bob played that part before. Was it done based on politics? I don't want to get into that. You got to give the guy credit. I thought he was going to say no. I wouldn't have believed him, but I thought he was going to say it. I give the guy credit. He didn't say no, it wasn't resolved on politics. He said, let's talk about something else. kind of similar to the way he responded to me. He does go on, though. She pushes him to give a convoluted reasoning. Let's hear it. Let's hear him out.
In the case, whether the scheme that the Florida Supreme Court had put together violated the federal constitution, that wasn't even close. The vote was 7-2.
Whether the scheme put together by the Florida court, what was that scheme? The scheme was to count the votes. Boy, what a scheming thing that is to do. What a disgusting, scheming criminal act to count the votes. You'd think this was a democracy or something. Phew, Mussolini never would have allowed that. What if the scheme was good under federal constitutional law? Now, you can criticize what the Florida Supreme Court did. You can. As when he points out it was 7-2, he points out that two of the four dissenting justices, and it wasn't two, it was four, pointed out that perhaps the best way to do it was to count all the votes, over votes as well as under votes, and the Florida Supreme Court had just counted under votes, and that might be a better way to do it. But you know what? That isn't the role of the Supreme Court. The final arbiter of Florida law is Florida. And the final arbiter of Florida law in Florida is the Florida Supreme Court. You can criticize what the Florida Supreme Court did if you want, but it ain't the role of the Supreme Court to do that. This is basic law school stuff. Now, it may sound to a non-lawyer like, oh, well, you know, the Supreme Court can overturn the Florida Supreme Court. You know, that makes sense. But if you think that way, with all due respect, you've been tricked. That's not the law. Ask any lawyer whether the Supreme Court can overturn the Florida Supreme Court, and the answer is only if it violates federal law. But the final arbiter of Florida state law is the Florida Supreme Court. And under federal law, under the Constitution and the federal law passed after the Hayes-Tilden election, Florida is the final arbiter of the electoral count. The Supreme Court didn't have jurisdiction at all to even take the case. Scalia, of course, doesn't mention that, neither does Leslie Stahl. Let's continue.
Moreover, he says it was not the court that made this a judicial question.
It was Al Gore who made it a judicial question. It was he who brought it into the Florida courts. We didn't go looking for trouble. It was he who said, I want this to be decided by the courts. What are we supposed to say? Oh, not important enough.
No, you're supposed to say you don't have jurisdiction. Way to blame the victim, Nino. And way to rewrite history. History will show, and I defy anyone to show me otherwise. In fact, I'll bet whatever you want. $1,000? $1,000 if you can show me otherwise. Bush went to the courts first. He went to the federal courts and said federal courts intervene, because he got before a good federal judge that was a conservative. And the federal courts properly said, we don't have jurisdiction, George. Get out of our face. This is a Florida issue. It went up to the Federal Court of Appeals. George Bush went to them, and they said, sorry, we don't have jurisdiction. Actually, some very conservative justices said, we don't have jurisdiction. It's a Florida issue. Al Gore did go to the Florida state courts because that's what you do under Florida law in a close election. In fact, that's true in all 50 states in every close election. If you dispute a recount by a certain, Bush campaign manager, who's also the Secretary of State of Florida by the name of Catherine Harris, what do? You go to the courts. That's the law. Gore went by the law, which said Florida decides. Bush did not go by the law. Bush tried to go to the federal courts, who had no jurisdiction, they told him again and again and again. And Scalia acts like it's Gore's fault. The reason the case is named Bush v. Gore and not Gore v. Bush is that the person who's filing for relief in any court always gets their name first. Bush was the upset party. Bush was upset by the Florida Supreme Court decision. Bush took the case to the United States Supreme Court. And Antonin Scalia, who's supposed to care about the law, and not about how important the case is. Did you already said, oh, it's not important enough? Guess what? It doesn't matter how important it is. When you don't have jurisdiction, you don't have jurisdiction. You can't take the case. He had no power to take the case. He grabbed power where he had no power at all. Another name for that is a coup d'etat. So let's hear his little argument with Leslie Stahl over whether the decision was political.
But it was it ended up being a political decision. It ended up in effect.
You say that? I don't say that.
You don't think it handed the election to George Bush?
Well, how does that make it a political decision?
It decided the election.
Oh, I see. If that's all you mean by it, yes.
That's all I mean by it.
Okay. I suppose it did. Although you should add to that that it would have come out the same way no matter what.
Wrong, 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 wrong. It would have come out the same way no matter what. That is false. That is a lie. That is a despicable lie. As even Matt Drudge was forced to concede, under any system where you count all of the Florida votes, Al Gore was our elected president. Not just by the popular vote, but by the electoral vote. He got the most votes in Florida. And as much as the Republicans try to rewrite history, as much as they try to cite an article which does say that if you only count some of the votes, Bush could have won, when you count all of the votes, which is what you're supposed to do in a democracy, Gore wins even when you throw away the more than 10,000 votes intended for him in Palm Beach County by people who were cheated out by the butterfly ballot. Even without the butterfly ballot, Gore wins. Scalia is simply lying to us. Now listen to his tortured logic over torture.
Justice has been explaining his positions publicly more and more, and even delving into some thorny issues like torture.
I don't like torture. Although defining it is going to be a nice trick, but I mean, who's in favor of it? Nobody. And we have a law against torture. But if everything that is hateful and odious is not covered by some provision of the Constitution.
If someone's in custody, as in Abu Ghraib, and they are brutalized by a law enforcement person, if you listen to the expression, cruel and unusual punishment, doesn't that apply?
No.
Cruel and unusual punishment.
To the contrary. You think that you would... Has anybody ever referred to torture as punishment?
Well, I think if you're in custody and you have a policeman who's taken you into custody...
And you say he's punishing you?
Sure.
What's he punishing you for? You punish somebody...
Well, because he assumes you one, either committed a crime or that you know something that he wants to know.
It's the latter. And when he's hurting you in order to get information from you...
Yeah.
You don't say he's punishing you. What's he punishing you for?
Because he thinks you're a terrorist and he's going to beat the you-know-what.
Anyway, that's my view, and it happens to be correct.
He's nothing if not certain and confident.
Certain and confident. Anyway, that's my view, and it's correct. Blah, 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 blah. Moving on. So there, I'm right. Next question. I can't answer that. Next question. Well, he doesn't say I can't answer that, but when he goes into the next question, that's what he's doing. So there, I'm right. This is old news. Move along. There's nothing to see here. Torture isn't punishment. It isn't? Because I think people who are being tortured probably feel like they're being punished. What happened to the textualist? What happened to the original intent? What happened to understanding the Constitution as it was written? The last point I want to make, and it's one where I may have to go over a little bit into Bob's show, has to do with another example of Scalia hypocrisy. Another example of where he's not being an originalist, but where he is putting his religion, his Catholic religion, ahead of what he claims to be original intent. First, a segment from 60 Minutes where she talks about the fact, the little known fact, that a majority of the Supreme Court, 5 out of 9 now, are Catholics. Now, I got nothing against Catholics. Most Catholics are good liberals. But it is.